couple of years ago when we were here, Fahrenheit, and I sort of feared you entered the scene that year as a filmmaker, and you left John as being John Lennon. There were thousands of people trailing you as you walked the Croisette. I was very impressed. I just want you to know. But speaking of Fahrenheit, one of the happy news events that made things brighter for you was Disney's stupid behavior and giving you one that publicity. Now, was that pre-planned?
No. Michael Eisner made a decision after he saw the film, and actually he didn't see the film. He sent one of his minions to see the movie, and he showed up on my 50th birthday and wanted a screening of the film. And I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm turning 50 right now." So I left him in the office with one of the editors, and he sat there and watched it. And did I ever tell you this story? How we got the jump on Eisner? This VP of Disney, he told the editor, "Oh, this is a great film. This is wonderful. You guys have done such a great job." So the editor calls, me and, "Oh, you aren't going to believe this. The Disney people love it. Oh, wow, that's so cool." A couple hours later, this guy had gone down to the village to eat dinner in a restaurant owned by the best friend of the producer of the movie, of our movie. And he happened to overhear the Disney guy telling his dinner party how he was going to go back and tell Eisner, "There's no way we can release this movie." And this is on a Friday night. So he calls the producer, the owner of the restaurant. The producer calls me. And we had from Friday night till Monday morning. We knew before Eisner knew that Disney wasn't going to release the film. So we had a good 48 to 72 hour jump on planning how we were going to deal with the fact that we no longer had a distributor for this film. Don't tell them I told that story.
Eisner.
No, no, no.
Now, you make films not just to entertain people, but let's face it, you want to change the world. You want to change things. Did you suffer a period of a bit of a downer when you realized that America was indeed, despite your splendid polemic, heading still and irrevocably in the direction of Bush America?
Well, I think those of us who share my political feelings felt very bad about the election. But I knew that there was only going to be 4 months between Fahrenheit 9/11 and the election. And, we live in a nation where we, at least when it comes to politics, we're essentially a nation of slow learners. And it takes us a while to figure things out. And that's no secret to the rest of the world. So the American public wasn't going to figure it out about Bush in those 4 months. Young people figured it out. And we took that film and we created this tour. We went to 62 campuses. We did all basketball arenas, mostly on most of these campuses, 10 to 15,000 students a night in September and October before the election. And and young people became the only age group that John Kerry won. It's the only age group he won, 18 to 29. And there was a 9% increase of the number of young people that voted in 2004 that voted in 2000. That's a huge jump, 9%. So I felt very good about that. And I realized that sooner or later, the American people would come along and realize that Bush had lied about this war and the war was wrong. And sure enough, here we are, 3 years later, 72% of the public, with Bush's approval ratings, 28%, that's the low point for him. Only 28% approve of him now. And when we sat here before, 3 years ago, I wasn't necessarily in the majority of public opinion in America. And now, 3 years later, I'm deep in the mainstream of public opinion. So,
America, you're almost on the right now. we have, again, a contest coming up. Which, two things, which of the candidates that confront us do you feel are most in sync with your views about healthcare, number one? And number two, Harvey, Hillary, did he ask you or in any way to deal with the content of the movie as far as Hillary was concerned?
I'll take the last part of the question first. I guess people know that Harvey has been a big supporter of the Clintons and certainly of Hillary. And I certainly had very good feelings about Hillary for most of her political life. And in fact, I had a chapter in my first book 11 years ago called My Forbidden Love for Hillary. But as I point out, I don't know, have many of you seen the film yet, or is it...
Yes.
In the film, there's basically a love poem to her with the Staples Singers singing underneath, some sexy music, and some of the best pictures of Hillary you'll ever see. And it kind of looks like I'm going and supporting her, and then basically I, at the end of it, point out that she's the second largest recipient of healthcare industry money in the U.S. Senate. And she's gone from being, you know, a hero on this issue 14 years ago to being now the largest recipient of these people's money, which is very depressing. Yes, Harvey did ask me if that had to be in the movie, and has called me a few times, just wondering if it was still in the movie. Yes, it is still in the movie, and Harvey respects me as a filmmaker, and he's not going to tell me this has to come out of the movie or whatever, but he does support her, and I respect that, and but I think for a lot of us, and I think this is why, not that I want to play political commentator here, but I think that the base of the Democratic Party that does show up in the primaries, this isn't going to be news to the Hillary campaign people, is that she's got a difficult time because the base knows that she not only voted for the war, she supported the war until January of this year. And it will be very hard for hardcore Democrats and true liberals to vote for her with that in mind. Having said that, I mean, I think she's great on a whole bunch of other things. And as far as the candidates who are running, I don't think any of them really have the plan that I would like to see. I think we need to eliminate private health insurance companies. I think we absolutely no need. You cannot have a profit-based system when it comes to health care. You wouldn't do it with the fire department. You wouldn't say to the fire department, hey, what kind of profit are these guys making for us? Right? It's an insane thought, isn't it? Or the police department, or the city water department. Hey, the water company, we're not making any profit on that. No, these are things you need. These are life and death issues, as is healthcare. And so that's why private profit-making companies have to be removed from the equation. The drug companies, we actually do need medication. So what they need to be is highly regulated and controlled, like Con Ed. I mean, they've got to be treated like a utility. We need them, but we, the people, control their profits and how they function and what they put out to the public.
In view of that, were you surprised in any way that some of the most carping questions asked at press conferences were from European writers whose governments tacitly embraced your idea?
Yeah, the press conference the other day was the Canadians doing most of the whining. But I say that in the film, you know, because we're in a waiting room in a Canadian hospital. And I just want to know, you know, just randomly, and we're just asking people, you know, how long you've been waiting here? And how long did it take? We asked them as they were coming out, how long did it take you to wait before you saw somebody? 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. That was about it. There's no 4-hour wait. And what have we as Americans heard about the Canadian system? All you do is wait in line, right? Can't get in, can't get help. That's not what I found. And so the Canadian press conference, the Canadian press, all stood up and told their stories of how they had to wait or whatever. But one of the women in the waiting room said, look, you know, you have to understand, you know, we complain a lot here in Canada. And then I say to her, I know, you're Canadian. Canadians, you know, I love the Canadians. I think if you see my past films, I hold them up to a very high standard, and you know, but they have a, you know, they're a country that has a hard time accepting a compliment. I mean, they got to live next door to us, so they have a lot of inferiority stuff going on. I can't get into the psychological stuff, but you know, the fact is that there are flaws and problems in every system. There's flaws in the British system. There's flaws in the French system. There's flaws in the Canadian system. Ask any of them if they'd like to trade their French, British, or Canadian healthcare card for your HMO card, and the answer every single time is no. And that's because they know the truth. And there's no disputing the facts. Canadians and Brits and French live longer than us. The Canadians live 3 years longer than we do. The AMA just did a report this past year. The poorest British citizen, the poorest Brit, lives longer than the wealthiest American. That's an indisputable fact. And when you see these facts laid out, then you have to ask yourself, which system would you rather have, in spite of its flaws that it does have?
And in spite of their bad teeth. No, some of the Brits. Some of the Brits did say that their health care is a bit like the canned film.
On the DVD, I'm going to have a DVD extra of nothing but Brits smiling so they can show what wonderful teeth they have.
Some of our British friends did say that the their health system is a bit like the Cannes Film Festival. It's a long line to nowhere.
That isn't true about the lines. The only line that's longer, really longer, in Britain is the line where they get to live longer. They live longer than we do, so they're in that long line. What you do have to wait for in Britain and Canada is a knee replacement, liposuction, things that are not life-threatening. If you have a life-threatening emergency, if you need help right away, you are taken care of right away, and they'll never ask you for a cash, a credit card, or any of this nonsense. It's what do you need, what can we do, and how fast can we do it? And that's how they do it in those countries. And I'm going to speak out against all the propaganda that has been placed on the American public about these systems. And I know it's difficult because in the Orwellian way that happens to me is that I'm the one that said, oh, he's putting out the propaganda. I'm like the one voice marching up against all of the lies that are perpetrated upon the American public, in this case with healthcare. And as I said at the press conference the other day, at some point, I hope I can catch a break here because, you know, how much longer do I have to keep doing this? Take the shit for it. And then 3 years later, oh, you know, maybe, you know what I'm saying? I'm a human being, too, so I have to live through all this, and then, frankly, I don't enjoy it. And, you know, I don't...
One of the realities as a member of the press is that healthcare is not exactly a sexy story. And that's why the journalism of healthcare has not distinguished itself. Now, one of the riveting elements in the movie is the whole episode involving Cuba. What can you tell us as to how you got there and where you got?
All right, well, let me start with the first thing you said about healthcare is not a sexy story. And
I can't get away with a thing.
I agree with you. I think that to set out to make a film. I remember the first day we all got together as a crew, and I said, you know, I think we got a big problem here, because nobody's going to say, you know, on a Friday night after working hard all week, hey, what do you want to go see tonight? Oh, I want to go see the healthcare documentary. nobody is going to go see that. And so we start out making a film knowing that nobody wants to see this as a movie. And how can we make this interesting and entertaining, provocative, important? How can it be a call to action and a work of art at the same time? So that's, to me though, that's a challenge. And so you asked about Cuba. I hate to give away, but I guess it's kind of, it's been reviewed and discussed now. So I, the last couple of weeks before coming here, I had to read in the newspaper how, you know, I'm being investigated because we went to Cuba. Of course, the people who wrote those stories didn't know, hadn't seen the movie. So they didn't know that what actually we set out to do was we were going to Guantanamo Bay, to the American soil that exists on the Cuban island. And we were going there to take these 9/11 rescue workers who are suffering from respiratory illnesses, who have received no help from the U.S. government for this. So we find out that the detainees that we're holding there in Guantanamo Bay, the people that we're accusing of creating 9/11, that they have some of the best health care anywhere. They have free universal health coverage. They have nutrition counseling. There's a list you can get from the government of how many teeth cleanings they've done, how many root canals, how many colonoscopies. What they call colonoscopies. I don't see many 50-year-old detainees down there. I don't know why they would need a colonoscopy. But Senator Frist in the film says that they do routine colonoscopies. So I wanted to take our 9/11 rescue workers, our heroes, down there to get the same care that our government is giving Al-Qaeda. And that was the premise of that. And then being turned away, we're now stuck in Cuba. Well, let's see what they have. We would have done that same scene had the detainees been held at a naval base that we have in Italy, or a naval base we have in the Philippines, or Australia, no matter where the country would have been. We would have then gone and said, well, let's see what the Italians have, and if they can help the 9/11 workers. It just so happened, I didn't place the detainees in Cuba. Bush did. That's why we were in Cuba. And, now we're in this kind of... we're being harassed by the Department of Treasury for this, and threatened, and having to do strange things like get prints of the film out of the countries before they take them from
us. Did you, in fact, send some prints out of the
We made a master duplicate of the film, yes.
What was your concern, Michael, specifically?
They're claiming that we violated the trade embargo and the travel embargo against Cuba. And by going down there and taking down high-definition tape that was worth $50 a tape, once we shoot it, the value of that $50 tape is now worth potentially millions of dollars. So we created a value in Cuba, which they may define as a violation of this embargo, and they then have the legal right to confiscate, just as if we had gotten other things in Cuba and brought them back here, like the cigars that Fred Thompson smokes. So the lawyers said, if there's even a 10%, 20% chance of them confiscating anything up here that we have, it's best that we get something out in the next 24 hours. Let's just get it out of the country. And I just thought that was kind of ridiculous. I mean, I'm an American. I live in the United States of America. They have to get something out of the country so we can then show it in Cannes. It seems like we're talking like I'm from another place, not this place. So, but they said, the Bush administration, do you put anything past them at this point? They have absolutely no respect for the law or the Constitution.
So you feel really that they're going to continue, the government is going to continue to essentially help you publicize the film.
Well, listen, as I told you earlier, if I were them, if they were going to go after me, let the film come out and then do this 6 or 9 months from now, because you can still do it then, and then they can put me through the ringer and do whatever. They wanted to create some harm to me personally. But to do it the week before we come to Cannes, we just looked at each other and we're like, because we were going to come here very quietly. Nobody'd seen the film. We had no screens. No press had seen it. We were very, you haven't seen me on TV, very quiet, very nothing. We're just going to show the film here and see what happens. And they started this whole publicity thing for the film. And I just think this is an administration that is so profoundly stupid.
Here, here. You know,
from the war to Katrina to some small potatoes thing like this, it doesn't matter what they touch. Don't you agree? Don't you say, isn't anybody thinking there? Is there anybody with a brain?
I think it's hard to find anyone who's still in office. I mean, the fallout has been so extraordinary now. They talk about a completely isolated presidency. I think you're finding, we were in the White House a few weeks ago. We were wondering if anyone was still home.
What were you doing there at the White House?
I wouldn't want to tell you. But we were not on our way to Cuba. I'll keep it that way. Given the fact that it was sort of a stealth marketing effort up front, picture's coming out very soon. You are a master at marketing a picture. Don't you feel it's too quick a release, that you should keep it for a while, give it more time to build?
Is that your advice, or?
That's a question.
Well, the way I feel right now is the quicker we get it out there, the better. So,
I wouldn't want to wait around too much longer.
We always intended to come to Cannes, and just like with Fahrenheit, we intended this to be a summer movie. We think that adults and young people with a brain wish that they had something to go to in the summer. And I don't think that summer should just be ceded over to the big mindless blockbuster. Don't you feel that way? Don't you, in the middle of the summer, say, geez, I'd like to go to an intelligent film that respected my intelligence and whether it was funny or whether it was tragic or whatever the MO of the film was. Right?
I do, but I think there's one ingredient to the picture that maybe you underestimate, and that is that it's had a considerable emotional impact on the audience. People are profoundly touched, even some of my hard-boiled reporters. And I think pictures that do have that emotional clout can carry an enormous word of mouth. So, A, I do congratulate you for that element of the picture. And B, I wish there was lots of time to build.
Now you're scaring me. I don't know what to say. You know, I'm not a distributor, so I don't know what... I'm just a moviegoer, so what I just said is the real reason. I just wish there was something to go to in the summer, and occasionally there'll be a Talladega Nights, which is a brilliant big film. But those Talladega Nights films are rare. By the way, if you haven't seen it, if you're too smarty pants, like, oh, I'm not going to the NASCAR movie. Seriously, it was one of the funniest films I saw last year.
Now, we have to, unfortunately, move along because Michael has got to do something else imminently, but I would love to entertain a couple of questions from you guys because he's a very smart-looking audience. Sir.
Yeah, hello, I'm Eric from Sweden.
You're from Sweden?
Yes, you're
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, you guys invented it, you started it, right? So, and then we did put you in the movie. So my apologies to that. But actually, we went to Norway. That didn't make it in the film either. But Norway was so crazy good, so ridiculous, more ridiculous than France. They send you for a week to the Canary Islands to a spa in Norway. Your health insurance, if you have certain arthritis or rheumatism or whatever, you get to go. Seriously, they pay for a full week in the Canary Islands for you. We got so weirded out by that, we never even go to sleep.
What's your question? Have you ever seriously considering just calling it a day? I mean, you don't have to work anymore. You
have I ever considered just calling it a day, like wipe it up with all the grief and just say it, enough of this? Yeah, I think, sure, I'm normal. I think about that a lot. Yeah, I kid around to the crew that I'm only going to make two more documentaries and then, you know, I'm going to, you know, do something with the Ice Capades or something. But yeah, no, of course I feel that. And but I can't not do what I'm doing, and I think everybody else in this room needs to do what they need to do. All of us, whatever contribution we can make as citizens of the democracy, I should.
I don't see early retirement setting in.
Yes.
My name
is Joanne Lulett, and I'm from San Francisco, and I just wanted to say that all poor people in all countries. I wanted to ask if you put anything in the film about people like Sheila Kilroy from San Francisco, who's doing a really good single-payer alternative, an idea. And I'm hoping one of your documentaries is going to be on racism, looking at your tech. So.
Oh yeah, that's right. I wore this in the movie before the IMUS incident. Just a hat that I like. And I like Rutgers too because they don't get any respect. Yes, we're going to be talking more about the single payer stuff and the things the California Nurses Association positions for National Health Plan, things like that. There'll be things on my website, ways for people to get involved when the movie comes out, and so you know I hope to do all that. And, you know, I'll keep these answers short if you want to try and squeeze in as many as possible. The French system actually is a mixed system. It's not a single payer system. But our problem is that our private insurance companies are so used to billion-dollar profits that I don't know how we would ever wean them off this. And what we're going to end up with is what John Edwards and these politicians are going to propose is that we siphon our tax dollars. Let's have universal health care, but we'll then pay the Aetnas and the Humanas and the Kaisers to provide it. So they get to keep making their billion-dollar profits. That's not the case in France. Those private health insurance companies are severely regulated and are not allowed to gouge like that. We would first have to do that to allow the private companies anywhere near a public system. And now the woman next to you, sorry.
Thank you. You're my
sunshine
from Canada, so I'm not your queen. But
I will anyways. Because it's starting cold up there. Well, I hope that this film is a small contribution toward that that change. And what Tony Benn says in the film is what I really wanted to say in this movie. I'm using healthcare as a vehicle to get out a larger thing here, a larger idea. Just as Bowling for Columbine wasn't really about the Columbine shooting, it was just a jumping off point to talk about something else. And I'm hoping that Americans, when they watch this film, will leave the theater and think about how the American system is counterproductive to our best interests. It is not in our best interest to have this every man for himself, me way of living. And if we start to correct that, so many other things are going to fall into place and we're going to be a much better people. And I know that sounds all, you know, hokey and, you know, pushy, softy. What's that? What's the term? Touchy-feely. But then I'm taking over on Thursday, so I'm just kind of...
Guys, we have, unfortunately, have to stop. Michael, you're a great showman as well as a hell of a filmmaker, and I know this is going to do great for you. Thank you very much.